coming up on Star Stuff. Have scientists discovered a way of travelling faster than the speed of light? NASA announces plans for the biggest and most powerful rocket ever built. And an out-of-control spacecraft comes crashing back to Earth. The trouble is, scientists still aren't sure exactly where it hit. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
The world of science has been turned upside down with the release of a paper claiming physicists have detected the first ever example of something moving faster than the speed of light. A state which, up until now, has been considered the ultimate speed limit of the universe. The speed of light is 299,792.458 kilometers per second in a vacuum. That's about 1,080 million kilometers per hour. The new earth-shattering study, published on the pre-press physics blog archive.org, reports that subatomic particles called neutrinos have been clocked during a test in southern Europe, travelling at 300,006 kilometres per second, which is about 6 kilometres per second faster than possible based on our current understanding of the laws of physics. Scientists, not believing their own figures, spent 6 months checking, testing and then rechecking their results before publishing. And they've urged the international scientific community to check over their findings and replicate the experiment. Now, if verified, the findings would reshape our understanding of the physical world, blasting a massive hole in one of the fundamental basics of the laws of physics, Albert Einstein's famous theory of relativity. The experiment which came up with the amazing result is called OPERA. It involves scientists at CERN, the European Centre of Nuclear Research, which straddles the Franco-Swiss border near Geneva, and fellow researchers at the Gran Sasso Laboratory in Italy, some 730 kilometres away. The CERN scientists fired protons into a collider, generating muon neutrinos, which then travelled the 730 kilometres to the Gran Sasso detector in Italy, hitting the receiver as tau neutrinos. Neutrinos are extremely weakly interacting electrically neutral particles, and they change their characteristics, called flavours, as they age, from electron to muon to tau. They're so small, scientists have only recently discovered that they have mass. In nature, neutrinos are generated by the nuclear fusion process in the centre of stars like our Sun. They can also be made in supernova explosions, marking the death of the most massive stars. In fact, neutrinos are so weakly interacting that right now, millions of them are passing right through you, but of course you're totally unaware of it. In the OPERA experiment, the neutrinos fired from Geneva to Italy arrived 60 nanoseconds earlier than the 2.3 milliseconds taken by light to travel over the same distance. The results are based on the observation of over 15,000 neutrino events measured by Gran Sasso. And the measurements were precise to within 10 nanoseconds, meaning the results were well within the margin of error. The problem is, under Einstein's theory of special relativity, a physical object cannot travel faster than the speed of light in a vacuum. Mind you, it's not the first time this may have happened. A similar experiment back in 2007 called MENOS, which took place at the United States Fermilab Particle Accelerator, produced similar results, also hinting at superluminal speeds. Superluminal is the term scientists use when they talk about things travelling faster than light. The difference between MENOS and this experiment, however, is that MENOS had a far greater margin of error. Consequently, the final results were always in doubt. If the OPERA results are accurate, that doubt has now been blown out of the water. Dr. Nicole Bell is a theoretical physicist with the University of Melbourne.
Well, they apparently have evidence that neutrinos are travelling faster than the speed of light. And this contradicts everything we know about Einstein's theory of special relativity. So if this observation is true, it would be truly groundbreaking. But we would like to see a lot more evidence, I think, before we're going to take it seriously.
Neutrinos are extremely weakly interacting with pretty well everything else. How do we know that the neutrinos they captured in Italy were the same ones which actually left CERN?
Well, they didn't capture all of them. They captured a tiny fraction of the ones that left CERN. So they had a beam line of neutrinos with some specific energy pointing in some direction. And they never expected to detect all of them. They expected to detect some fraction of them. And what they detected was consistent with expectations.
Just a bit sooner than they expected.
A bit sooner than they expected, yes.
Neutrinos constantly change their flavour, don't they?
Indeed, and this experiment was designed to look for that effect. They're sending muon neutrinos from CERN, and they're looking for the appearance of tau neutrinos down at Gran Sasso in Italy. So this is one of the experiments designed to probe that effect of changing their flavour identity.
Why are they trying to do that?
Ultimately, this change in flavours tells you something about the neutrino masses, the size of the mass differences between the different sorts of neutrinos.
How do you generate a neutrino in a laboratory?
Well, CERN is doing it by, they're starting with protons, then they have some target, and they interact the protons and produce mesons like pions, which decay and produce neutrinos.
Right,
primarily muon neutrinos.
Yeah, so when you say interact, they're basically slamming a proton into something and one of the subatomic particles released is a neutrino.
Yes.
Yeah. They've made this experiment. They've detected this neutrino. It's arrived early. What are the possible reasons for a neutrino arriving early, other than it's superluminal, I mean?
If it's really arrived early, then it has gone faster than the speed of light. And you can't do that within any of our current theories. You'd have to go beyond our current theories to explain how neutrinos got there faster than light did. And so there's speculation involving theories with extra spatial dimensions. Instead of having three space dimensions and one time dimension, would have some extra ones, such that the quickest way from point A to point B isn't through regular space, but by leaving regular space and taking a shortcut through extra dimensions. The explanations are all things like that, which are really quite exotic and, you know, would require
new maths,
major
new
revisions
physics
to our theories and, you know, a lot of proof before we would, you know, take them on board.
All right, so with that in one box, then let's move to the other box. Let's say it really didn't travel faster than the speed of light. There was a problem somewhere else. What sort of problems are likely to occur that could give a false reading?
Well, we need to know about the degree of error on the measurement they've done. And you can have errors because you don't have enough statistics, you haven't got enough data to work with, and that's a statistical error. And you can also have errors called systematics. Essentially, we want to know how accurate their measurement is. And they could have underestimated the error on their experiment, such that they've told us they can measure these flight times to within a certain number of nanoseconds, and really that might be too optimistic. And so it would require the experimental physicist to really go back and analyse the degree of error in the experiment before we would be really confident that this was a real effect. We'd also like to see it confirmed by an independent experiment in a different location with a different group of scientists with completely different ways things could go wrong and see the same effect arising.
One of the things that have been touted was, of course, supernova 1987A, which exploded in the Large Magellanic Cloud, the largest nearby supernova in recent times. We know that produced an awful lot of neutrinos. They were detected exactly when they should have been detected here on Earth, not earlier. And if neutrinos really did travel faster than light, that would have been a good test to detect them earlier.
Right, so supernova 1987A, you can think of that as an astrophysics experiment to try and measure the same effect. And supernova are interesting because when a core collapse supernova occurs, basically all of the energy of the supernova comes out as neutrinos. The small optical display that astronomers look for in their optical telescopes isn't where all the energy is. All the energy is in neutrinos. And so the supernova 1987A made copious amounts of neutrinos, and we detected some of them on Earth. We detected roughly 20 of them on Earth. And they actually got here before the light did. They came about 3 hours earlier. That was expected. That's expected because neutrinos interact very weakly and get out of the supernova before the light does. The light interacts electromagnetically, so it's trapped there for a while, and then it eventually gets out a little bit later.
They say it can take millions of years for a photon to leave the core of the sun before it reaches the surface. Is that the sort of thing we're talking about?
That's the sort of thing, whereas neutrinos, they're produced, they come straight out.
So that's what happened in 1987A.
And if the neutrinos really went as fast as OPERA claims that they're going, they would have arrived here 4 years early. But they wouldn't have shown up in 1987, they would have shown up 4 years before that, and the light would eventually have shown up in 1987. And so instead of there being this three-hour difference between when the neutrinos and the light showed up, there would have been a four-year difference if the neutrinos really go as fast as the results of the OPERA experiment would seem to indicate. So this would seem to refute the OPERA measurement of the neutrino bead. There are differences, of course, between the two cases that you could use to reconcile them, but a simple-minded view of it is that this is not consistent with 87A.
That's Dr. Nicole Bell, theoretical physicist with the University of Melbourne. So, what happens now? Well, the next step will obviously be to duplicate the neutrino experiment in another laboratory, and that could be happening within months. The problem is there are, well, really only two facilities in the world capable of carrying out such tests. One is at Fermilab, just outside Chicago, where the 2007 MENOS test was carried out. The other is a site in Japan, where scientists last year detected neutrinos that had travelled the width of Honshu Island to the giant Super Kamiokande underground detector. Needless to say, whatever the outcome, scientists around the world will be watching closely. More from the ABC's Timothy MacDonald.
Even the team that made the discovery can scarcely believe it. That's because it should be impossible. Professor Geoffrey Taylor from the University of Melbourne's School of Physics explains.
As you try and push faster and faster, the usual laws of that we're used to with putting the accelerator down on the car to make it go faster, the laws change. That's an approximation that we see in our everyday life. And the more energy you push into a particle, it doesn't go any faster at some point. It just asymptotes to the speed of light.
And is it possible that we've got the speed of light wrong? Is it possibly another speed?
No, the speed of light is well measured and well understood, and there are all sorts of implications, astrophysical and as well as measurements on Earth, so that's pretty much not in dispute at all.
Now, assuming for just a moment that what they've done turns out to be correct, what would it mean for physics as we know it?
Oh, it would turn things completely upside down. That's probably why I'm so sceptical. We don't have any, in the standard model of everything that we understand, particles just can't go faster than the speed of light in this universe that we're part of.
So do you think that they've got it wrong?
Yes, it's a big experiment, and it's very sophisticated. It's hard to imagine exactly where such a big error could have come from. 60 nanoseconds sounds like a tiny amount, but it's well within the precision of measurement. So we talk about systematic errors where there's some mistake being made, not in a precision, but in the way the measurements have been carried out. So my guess is that there's something will show up in the experimental side that has not been thought about.
It really would cause us to rethink just about everything, wouldn't it? Being that it's the constant under which other ideas about the universe hang. This is the anchor, so to speak.
That's right. So it really is a definition of our understanding of space-time. So in some sense, it comes out of that. And so that relationship is absolutely key to the way we build our understanding. Absolutely. It would turn things completely upside down. That's why I'm so sceptical.
John Butterworth is a physics professor at University College London. He says if the discovery turns out to be true, it could have a major impact on our daily lives.
This is one of those things where it's so big, if it's true, that it's impossible to imagine the practical applications. I mean, when Einstein came up with relativity, I mean, you wouldn't have thought of GPS and mobile phones and things. And really, with fundamental physics, what we do is we're looking at how the universe works. When we find out how it works, we normally find a way to use that information. We found Earth-like planets recently somewhere else. You know, maybe this will help us get there quicker, but I wouldn't bet on it.
Of course, even the people who made the discovery are a little bit sceptical. CERN is due to publish its results soon. That will allow other labs to try to replicate their findings, which should give some indication if the findings are a major discovery or a mere error.
The ABC's Timothy MacDonald. The United States space agency NASA has unveiled plans for what will be the largest and most powerful rocket ever built. Depending on the stack's configuration, the SLS, or Space Launch System, will be capable of lifting payloads up to 130 tons into low Earth orbit. Now, that's 4 times the capacity of the Space Shuttle. SLS will come in 2 basic configurations. There's the manned version, which will carry NASA's new Orion multipurpose crew vehicle. That's one of the capsules designed to replace the space shuttle for deep space missions to an asteroid and eventually back to the moon and maybe one day even to Mars. The entire launch vehicle will be 98 metres high, as tall as the Statue of Liberty, and will weigh a crushing 2,500 tons at liftoff. The cargo version of the SLS will be even bigger, measuring a massive 122 metres in height. That's as tall as a 40-storey skyscraper, and it will have an all-up launch weight of 2,950 tons. Depending on its configuration, this massive rocket can produce up to 9.2 million pounds of thrust. That's as much as 34 Boeing 747 jumbo jets and some 20% more than the Saturn V Apollo moon rocket. Both versions of the SLS will share a common core stage. This core stage will use the same RS-25DE main engines used on the space shuttle. Bolted to the outside of the core stage will be either liquid or solid fuel strap-on booster rockets, also based on the space shuttle's reusable SRBs. The heavy lift cargo version will also be equipped with an upper stage. That'll use a J2X engine, similar to the type used on the second stage of the Saturn V moon rocket and also proposed for the Ares, which was the original successor design to the space shuttle, developed under the Bush administration and scrapped by President Barack Obama. According to NASA, it will cost about $10 billion to develop the new launch system, with the first flights tentatively slated for 2017. But while the announcement's generating tremendous enthusiasm within the space community, NASA watchers are questioning whether the US government will stick to the program. More from the ABC's Ashley Hall.
Nose gear touchdown. Having fired the imagination of a generation, a ship like no other, its place in history secured, the space shuttle pulls into port for the last time, its voyage at an end.
When the space shuttle Atlantis touched down for the final time earlier this year, it was a bittersweet moment for the close-knit NASA community. After 135 missions over 30 years, the shuttle workforce faced thousands of job losses. With NASA facing budget cuts and a plan to outsource the shuttle's replacement, some commentators began questioning whether the space agency had much of a future. But NASA's Administrator General Charles Bolden put paid to that.
The next chapter of America's space exploration story is being written today. Today I'm pleased to announce that NASA has selected the design of its new deep space system that will take American astronauts further into space than any nation has gone before, and create jobs right here at home.
The new rocket has been dubbed the Space Launch System. In size and shape, it's more reminiscent of the Saturn series of booster rockets that carried the Apollo astronauts to the moon in the late 1960s than to the space shuttle.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the rocket's use of liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen engines and fuel tanks borrows heavily from the shuttle.
We're already building a space capsule, the MPCV, to transport our astronauts into deep space. Now, we've selected a heavy lift rocket to carry the crew and capsule to destinations in space no nations have ever gone before.
If all goes to plan, NASA will launch its first unmanned test flight of the new rocket in 2017, with the first crew flying in 2021. General Bolden says astronauts would head to a nearby asteroid in 2025 and then to Mars in the 2030s.
We believe the President's request for space launch for the Space Launch System and the Orion multipurpose crew vehicle in 2012 are at the appropriate levels. And today, the administration has made a long-term commitment to these critical deep space exploration vehicles.
But exactly how firm is that commitment? Jonathan Nally is the editor of the Australian Space News website, spaceinfo.com.au.
There was a plan back in the sort of final years of the President Bush era to return to the moon, but that plan got cancelled. So NASA now intends, with government approval, to go deeper into space than the moon, to go to perhaps an asteroid and maybe even to Mars in the next 30 years or so. And to do that, they need to get some big heavy gear into space, for which they need a big heavy rocket.
How confident are you that this particular plan that they've got now will actually see it through, will be there in 20 or 30 years?
Well, I have to say that I'm never terribly confident with the American space program, and that's not saying anything against NASA. It's more a case of mismanagement by the American government, who keeps chopping and changing its ideas and giving funding and then taking it away. These long-term plans need long-term commitment, and political and budgetary cycles being what they are, it's very hard to achieve.
A decommissioned NASA satellite, the biggest piece of American space junk to fall back to Earth in 30 years, has crashed back to the surface, but scientists still aren't sure exactly where. The 6-ton upper atmosphere research satellite, called the UARS, was the size of a bus and re-entered the Earth's atmosphere sometime on Saturday afternoon. At the time, the spacecraft was travelling eastwards over the Pacific Ocean and may even have reached parts of Canada. It was the Space Shuttle Discovery which carried the Upper Atmosphere Research Satellite into Earth orbit back in 1991. With no fuel left for manoeuvring, the spacecraft was formally decommissioned in 2005, and its orbit began to decay due to atmospheric drag shortly after that. The tumbling motion of the spacecraft, combined with changes in the density of the Earth's atmosphere caused by fluctuations in solar activity, made it difficult for scientists to narrow down an exact target point for satellite entry. NASA says the debris field should span up to 800 kilometres. While most of the 11-metre probe would have burned up during its fiery re-entry, up to 26 fragments, constructed mostly out of stainless steel and titanium, are expected to have survived all the way down to the planet's surface. And the largest of those components would have weighed about 150 kilograms. NASA and US Defense Department officials were keeping both foreign governments and American federal disaster agencies informed. It's been 32 years since the 89-ton American space station Skylab crashed back to Earth in outback Western Australia. Despite the tabloid headlines, the Upper Atmosphere Research Satellite wasn't the largest piece of space junk to fall back to Earth in 30 years. That honour goes to the 130-ton Russian Mir space station, which deorbited in a fiery but controlled descent, crashing into the southeastern Pacific Ocean on the 23rd of March, 2001. Interestingly, scientists have calculated the chances of a person actually being hit by a piece of space junk. They say it's about 1 in 3,200. More from the ABC's Ashley Hall.
3, 2, 1.
What goes up?
0 and liftoff.
Must come down.
Discovery and the Upper Atmosphere Research Satellite.
The Space Shuttle Discovery carried the Upper Atmosphere Research Satellite into Earth orbit in 1991. It's the biggest NASA spacecraft to crash back to Earth in 3 decades, but it's far smaller than the Russian Mir space station that fell to Earth in 2001, and Skylab that crashed in Western Australia in 1979, causing enormous excitement and a certain amount of fear.
Skylab has fallen, and some of it hit Western Australia.
We actually heard the pieces going over the homestead. The sonic booms were here for about over a minute, and it shook the house, and for quite some time after, I suppose for 15 minutes or more after, the animals here were racing all over the place.
After Skylab's crash, the Shire of Esperance fined the US $400 for littering, but it refused to pay. The fine was eventually settled 30 years later by a radio host. Professor Stephen Freeland is a specialist in space law at the University of Western Sydney. He says the US would be responsible if the latest satellite crash caused any damage.
There is an international treaty sponsored by the United Nations, which is known as the Liability Convention. It was concluded in the early 1970s, and it sets a regime for liability for damage caused by space objects.
But Professor Freeland says it's unlikely to become a legal matter.
There was an event in the late 1970s where a Soviet spy satellite lost control and crashed in the Northwest Territories of Canada. That spy satellite indeed had a nuclear power source on board, so there was a spread of some radiation, and in that case, there were discussions between the Soviet Union and Canada with the idea of perhaps bringing an action, but in the end, there was an agreement reached and an ex gratia payment was made by the Soviet Union to Canada without admitting any liability.
And finally for this week, to the latest step by humans to reach the planet Mars. Six participants in a simulation project are finding out exactly how hard it may be to even make the psychological leap to Mars, let alone the physical one. You see, they're trying to stay in total isolation for 520 days. That's the time scientists think it would take to get a manned mission to Mars and back again. They've already been aboard their simulator since June last year. But it would appear the isolation and monotony is taking its toll, as the ABC's Stephanie Smale reports.
Diego Urbina has been isolated from the outside world for 15 months, and he misses it.
Simple things such as the blue sky, such as, I don't know, going dancing in the evening. I love that, and here I am not able to do it.
He's one of the six men from Russia, Italy, China and France who volunteered to simulate the year-and-a-half-long trip to Mars and back. Based at a special facility at the Institute of Biomedical Problems in Moscow, the men are living in a completely artificial environment with no daylight and no fresh air. Diego Urbina has been making video diaries during the project.
My family, I miss them a lot, and my friends. Well, in general, I miss a lot the randomness of the world.
And although there's only 2 months to go, the men are starting to struggle mentally. Jonathan Clark from the Mars Society of Australia says the isolation the men are experiencing is similar to teams who travel to the Antarctic. He says they experience a so-called third quarter syndrome when they're on the home stretch, but there's still a way to go.
After the halfway point and before the last quarter, when people will be getting ready to come home, there is a very low point in morale. Of course, going to a Mars mission, there's also an additional factor as well. In the Antarctic, when you winter over, things start to improve. Of course, going to Mars, the high point is the landing, which is halfway through, and then after you've had all the excitement of the landing and all the attention, then comes the hard slog of the 8-month trip. Simulated trip back to Earth.
The men have an internet connection and have been staying in touch with friends and relatives. Diego Urbina even has a Twitter account. But an artificial delay means direct conversations haven't been possible for months. The Mars Society's Jonathan Clark.
There are no windows, and of course this is something that's different to an actual space mission where you would have a spacecraft window, and of course as you get closer to Earth you'll see the Earth growing from a pale blue dot to an actual planet. I'm sure that would have a real influence on morale as well, and beginning sunlight through the windows. So yes, it's like a submarine. Yeah, they're very enclosed.
Project managers say the men have now set a record for the longest time away from the natural world in history, and the last 2 months of the project will provide invaluable insights into the psychological and health impacts of the experiment. Project manager Jennifer Go-Ahn says the men have found intriguing ways to keep their spirits up.
One thing that we did not foresee, but that they're using to break the monotony with, is creativity. So what they have been doing is, for Halloween, for example, they dressed themselves up with scientific equipment. For Christmas, they came up with their own self-made nativity scene. And they also celebrated the Chinese New Year.
Jonathan Clark says the experiment is an invaluable contribution.
You know, these things are experiments, and we do these experiments precisely so that we can find out how to manage it. And future attempts will be more successful than present ones, and when we're ready to go to Mars, then people will be even better at that.
That's Jonathan Clark from the Mars Society of Australia, ending that report by the ABC's Stephanie Smale. And that's the show for now. If you've missed part of it on the radio, or you just want to hear the show again, don't forget Star Stuff is available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/Star Stuff. The Star Stuff blog's always packed full of the latest news, spectacular images, stuff I find amusing, and heaps of other media we couldn't fit in the show. You can find it all at abcstarstufftumblr.com. That's all one word and in lower case, and that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed. For the latest developments in astronomy, cosmology, and space sciences as they happen, we give you current news, information, ongoing updates, and cool URLs. Just Google in the at symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all as one word in lowercase, and we'll keep you informed. And for all the news in science and technology, go to the ABC Science website at www.abc.net.au/science. And that's the show for now. A special thanks to ABC Radio National and the ABC Science Unit for all their help and facilities. I'm Stuart Gary, and we'll be back next week with more Star Stuff.